Icon Art Radio. Today's episode, the second part of Bill and Donna's interview with sound artist Alan Cobb.
Tell us about some of the things you've actually done. You've put two shows together that we've presented at the gallery, at Gallery 51 East, when it was working up on the third floor. Mm-hmm. And you created a space where people were experiencing space sonically. Mm-hmm. So you talk a little bit more about what you've done.
Well, that installation, which I called Ashtanga Kash, which is kind of fractured Sanskrit for eightfold space. When you walked into the room, you saw a kind of a sphere in the center of the room with eight small openings in it, standing on a pedestal. And around the walls, behind unobtrusive curtains, were eight hidden loudspeakers. And the room was basically silent. And after about 15 seconds of silence, one speaker or another, apparently at random, would reproduce the sound of a door opening onto an acoustical environment, a sound space of some kind. In the case of this installation, I used a forest full of chirping birds, a busy city intersection, a busy restaurant, surf, a distant thunderstorm, a train passing in the distance, and I don't think that's eight yet, but one or two others. And so you'd hear this sound with a very identifiable, characteristic spatial quality to it, and it would play for 10 seconds, and then the door would shut, and you'd hear the door shut, and it chops off that acoustical environment and kind of drops you back into the gallery space, which has its own acoustical
qualities. Yeah, and I had this experience too, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's very dramatic when you hear something cut off like that.
I don't think people realize how much the space around them is defined sonically.
Oh, yeah, yeah, absolutely. It's very powerful. I mean, this room here, I've got six, 7 foot tall sound absorbing baffles to try and hide the sound of this room, and that's not enough. You can still, when you listen to this program, you can still hear that we're in a room. It's very clear that we're not in a large meeting space, and we're not in an anechoic chamber, and we're in fact not even in as absorbent a room as a normal radio studio would be. The way this installation worked was that about every 15 seconds you'd hear another environment from another direction. And after a while, standing in the silence most of the time, you would realize that there was a very faint sound coming from the sphere. And if you stepped up close to the sphere and listened to the openings in the sphere, you would hear the same sounds that you had been hearing large through the big speakers. Only not interrupted by doors. It was ongoing. And so the conclusion that you came to kind of experientially, not necessarily conceptually, was that what's outside is also inside, and where you are is in the gap in between them. And I thought it was kind of neat to be able to make a seriously Vedic philosophical statement without using any words or explanations or saying anything or using language.
I remember that show too. It was really magical to me. And I think this show that we've just recorded is a total teaser, because I actually have many more questions about what you've been talking about today. And I think we're going to have to do more shows throughout the period of weeks with you telling us about sound, because I think it's fascinating.
Oh, yeah, it's fantastic. I mean, we could have a whole radio show just devoted to the work that he's doing.
Oh, thank you.
Now, the piece you just described is referential still to...
Yes.
And you have done work that solely sculpts space using timbre and spatiality.
Yeah, most of what I do is actually not conceptual art. Ashtanga Kash was very conceptual, although wonderfully nonverbal. which in itself is kind of an interesting idea that you could, we have concepts that are not verbal. They're only verbal when we try to express them out loud. But our fundamental perception of things is always conceptual, and only rarely is it verbal. So what I've been doing is trying to play with, I guess, what you can think of as sounds of the fourth kind. The first kind we could say is speech, the second kind is music, and the third kind is sound effects or sounds that we recognize. And then sounds of the fourth kind are everything else. And there's quite a lot of everything else. In fact, most sound is part of the fourth category. All of this timbre, all of this spatiality content is really of the fourth kind. So it took me a couple of years to learn how to virtually eliminate all of these other qualities from the sounds that I was working with. And I start with synthesizer equipment, and I build, you know, waveforms that have the kind of sound I'm thinking of, which usually means sounds I don't remember hearing myself, and sounds that do not have a particularly dominant melodic quality or harmonious quality, although I'm not after dissonance like some of the early experimenters who liked to listen to ring modulators oscillating and overloading and clipping and things. Those make interesting sounds also. I mean, all sounds are interesting in one way or another if they're not too loud. When they are too loud, your ear actually distorts in the same way that a speaker distorts. And this is one of the great tragedies of modern technology. I think we get to listen to great musicians playing fantastic music through speakers that are turned up so high that the speakers themselves are usually distorting. And the ears of the people listening to it, much as they like that visceral thump of the bass on their chest, and you know they like to see their pant legs flapping and to the rhythm of the music, unfortunately they're not hearing most of what those musicians are creating. And perhaps even more unfortunately, the musicians, having been playing on stage in deafening sound fields for hours and hours over many years, their hearing is so grotesquely impaired in most cases that they don't hear what they're playing much anymore either. Pete Townsend of The Who has been on a crusade for the last few years trying to educate rock musicians about what they're actually doing to themselves, because he's very deaf now and he's very sorry about it. But anyway, that's my little lecture on on sound safety.
Thank you.
But the pieces that I've heard that you've done, you've given me a number of recordings over the years, take a person into a place where they're capable of deepening their perception, of hearing more. And I just go further and further into my refined sonic perception as a result of your work.
Yeah, well, that's what I'm trying to accomplish. I've found people tend to respond to these pieces in one of two ways, or of course a blend of the two. One is some people are so habituated to identifying whatever they hear, and it's built into the nervous system. It's not like it's a habit. You almost have to identify what you hear. But they're so oriented towards that when they hear these compositions, which are trying to be primarily things that do not represent anything that you already know, they will then build something. They'll build a mental image of what would have to exist to make a sound like that. And you know, you'll hear people saying, "Oh, I particularly liked that section with the 150-foot rubber band." And yeah, it sounded a little bit like a 150-foot rubber band. And if I had played notes on it, you would have begun thinking about the bass line, which is not where I want to take your attention. So yeah, it's a rubber band, and then it turns into something that's hard to describe, and you're left having the other response that people often have, which is that the brain kind of gives up. And stops classifying everything that it hears and just is able to absorb the impulses as they come in.
You explained what your installation was like so that people who didn't actually hear it could kind of get what it was. So what are these recordings and what kind of range do you put onto them?
I've been working on multi-channel presentations. And of course, this is unfortunate because you have to have a big room with 8 speakers and 8 amplifiers and a lot of good sound absorbing material around and then sit in the middle of that to listen to one of my compositions. So I kind of need a special concert hall for them, and I usually don't have one handy. Although I hope that the armory will become that in the next year or so after we fix the acoustics. I compose mostly for 8 channels, and what I'm doing is I'm trying to orchestrate as many as 8 individual unrecognized sounds. That hopefully they're all appealing sounds, interesting sounds, sounds with timbres that are fascinating and worthy of close listening. But at the same time, because they're unfamiliar sounds, if you mix them together into a stereo image, what happens is 2 unfamiliar sounds simply become a third unfamiliar sound, and you don't ever have the impression that it's 2 sounds. You just hear one. And if I put 8 channels into a stereo sound field, you kind of just hear one sound that's very complex and subtle and full of, you know, transitions and changes and things. But it's not at all what it is that I'm trying to play with, because space is the thing that's really most tricky to manipulate. And it's one of the things that's most exciting and interesting to experience. So I've gotten around that limitation a little bit by using binaural processing. I take my 8 channel originals, and instead of running them through 8 amps into 8 speakers in a big room, I take each channel separately and process it through a special kind of software that positions it exactly the way you would hear it positioned if you were in a room listening to it. Now, humans don't hear behind very accurately, so I don't try to make a circle out of the 8 channels. I make about 180 degree arc of the 8 channels, or maybe a 200 degree arc. And it turns out that if you listen to recordings that are processed this way, and they're called binaural recordings, and they're usually made in a live situation with a dummy head, a sculpted head of a human, often with hair and shoulders and neck. And the microphones are in the ear canals of the dummy head, so that you're actually capturing what would be getting to the eardrums of a person in the position that you put the head. And when you play that back on headphones, you get an uncannily accurate sense of the spatiality of the event. If you go into a room full of people all talking at once and decide one conversation is more interesting than the others, you can focus your attention on that conversation. And that it's called the cocktail party effect. And somehow you can ignore the other conversations. Well, if you make a conventional monophonic or stereo recording of that and play that back on speakers, you can't use the cocktail party skill. The cocktail party effect doesn't work. Everybody's talking at once and you can't differentiate one conversation from another. The reason for that is that you have lost all of the spatial information, or most of the spatial information. And now we're talking about even subtler spatiality than what I was, you know, demonstrating before with cathedrals and shower stalls. The distance between your ears is enough to slow down the sound so that the sound from the right hits your right ear about 0.7 thousandths of a second before it hits your left ear. And within the frequency ranges that whose wavelengths are approximately of that scale, for those of you who are thinking about physics at the moment, within certain frequency ranges, around the kind of middle range of human hearing, that kind of positioning information is incredibly powerful. In fact, if you make a speaker click with a pair of speakers, and you change the timing of the click so that it comes out of one speaker a few tenths of a millisecond sooner than the other speaker, you'll hear it as coming from that first speaker's direction. You won't hear the second speaker at all. You'll say, oh, it's to the left. And if the right-hand speaker is a few tenths of a millisecond sooner, you'll say, oh, it's coming from the right, even though it's exactly the same loudness. So when you make a recording with a dummy head and listen to it on headphones, suddenly you're back at the party and you can pick out one conversation and listen to it, and then play the tape again and listen to a different conversation. Mm-hmm. You're sort of, you're able to arrange the orchestra. You can choose to listen to this instrument or that instrument. And it's very, very powerful. I mean, it's an amazing experience if you've never heard a binaural recording, and most people haven't.
So do you use a dummy head? You have one that
Well,
you
see, my recordings are, my music is all already in the computer. It's mostly created in the computer. So it never happens in the physical world until I play it through the eight speakers. Now, the best way to record it would be for me to wear microphones on my ears. It turns out they don't actually have to be in your ear to do a very good recording. And then sit in a room with eight really good speakers producing my music. In lieu of that, I have software that can simulate the same thing. I could take each of those eight individual channels and process it for a specific position and then mix them all together and make a two-channel binaural recording out of that. So if you went to my website and downloaded one of the binaural tracks and played it back on headphones, you would hear these unrecognizable sounds coming from depending on how effectively binaural works for you, you know, six or eight different positions.
What is your website?
It's called timbreproductions.com.
Spell timbre?
Yeah, that's a French word. It's T-I-M-B-R-E productions.com. Thank you. been listening to Icon Art Radio, an outreach program of Iowa Contemporary Art. This has been part two of Bill and Donna's interview with sound artist Alan Cobb. Hey, that's me. This is KRUU LP, 100.1 FM, Fairfield.